Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to Blog Talk Radio and the Cosmic Citizen. My name is Paula Thompson. I'm your host, and with me are my dear friends and co-hosts, Chuck Thurston, Andre Rodatis, and Marvin Garwin. Hi, you guys.
Hey, good morning,
Paula.
Everybody.
Good morning.
Good morning.
Yeah. Hi, Paula. Hi, folks.
Hi. So happy Easter.
Coming right up.
Coming right up. You know, we...
yeah,
Jerry, happy Marantia Transit, almost resurrected.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That's right, yeah. It's, of course, this is in the Christian calendar. In the Arantian calendar, we're not quite there yet, but good enough.
Right.
Good enough.
But
we
good
can
enough.
Celebrate twice. And maybe thrice if we go with the Eastern Rite. So...
Yeah, this Saturday between the crucifixion and the resurrection is known as the time of the tomb, and I like to reflect on that quite a bit because sometimes it feels like we're in that, doesn't it? It feels like we're in the darkness and the uncertainty, the time of the tomb. You know, not that Jesus was uncertain, but certainly his apostles were, and they were reflecting in this day. You know, there's a wonderful quote about it being gloriously bright on the day of resurrection. But what were you going to say, Chuck? I didn't mean to.
Derek wanted me to pass along his good wishes for Easter.
Aww.
Oh, wonderful.
So,
yeah.
You guys. Yeah. Just wishing you guys a happy, happy Easter.
Well, best wishes to Derek.
Yeah.
Yeah. We miss him. He can come on sometimes, you know.
Yeah, we could.
Well,
we could do that.
He's off kayaking today.
Oh, is he? Well, that's he's out in nature.
Seizing the opportunity.
Yeah, he loves that kayak.
And what's not to love about that?
Yeah.
Here's the quote that I was just referring to, and this is just for Easter, a little respite from our great study that we're doing, which is on Seraphic Guardians of Destiny, Guardian Angels, and we're on Section 5, Seraphic Ministry to Mortals, which will be a great section, and we'll start reading that in a little bit. But I wanted to share this for Easter time. This is from Paper 194, Section 3, Paragraph 2. Many things which happen in the course of a human life are hard to understand, difficult to reconcile with the idea that this is a universe in which truth prevails and in which righteousness triumphs. It so often appears that slander, lies, dishonesty, and unrighteousness, sin, prevail. Does faith, after all, triumph over evil, sin, and iniquity? It does. And the life and death of Jesus are the eternal proof that the truth of goodness and the faith of the Spirit-led creature will always be vindicated. They taunted Jesus on the cross, saying, "Let us see if God will come and deliver him." It looked dark on that day of crucifixion, but it was gloriously bright on the resurrection morning. It was still brighter and more joyous on the day of Pentecost. The religions of pessimistic despair seek to obtain release from the burdens of life. They crave extinction and endless slumber and rest. These are the religions of primitive fear and dread. The religion of Jesus is a new gospel of faith to be proclaimed to struggling humanity. This new religion is founded on faith, hope, and love. Yay. Thanks, Midwayers. I think about that, the glorious brightness of resurrection morning. What a joyful thing that must have been for them.
Well, for all of us,
The extremes
of that whole series of episodes are kind of staggering, if you think about it, particularly if you bring in the cosmic significance of it all. I mean, talk about a drama. Wow. Talk about suspense. You know? Completely, completely over the top. Can't imagine being those apostles. what an experience. Gosh.
Yeah, they weren't inclined to believe it at first, and I think we have to wonder if we would have been, you know, if we would have been inclined to believe it after witnessing what they and knowing what they knew, you know.
Well, it was a definite test of faith. They knew, they could recognize it. They were able to recognize
the
spirit of truth.
Yeah, good point. Yeah.
Which has kind of changed everything.
Well, you know, part of what I'm struck by is the word contrast has been in my thoughts a lot, and what a life we live in of contrasts. You know, that section we read a couple of weeks ago about the human condition, and I think it might have been one of the angels or might have been the adjuster speaking to their subject where they talk about, you know, the good.
The
whale
of, of faith. Poisoned by fear, et cetera.
Exactly. And I think there's no more great contrast than we deal with in this life than the contrast between death and life. You know, what we look at as the cessation of all existence, the end point and nothing more, and the terrors that humanity has around death and life eternal. And that's what the resurrection was about, that incredible contrast and the contrast between good and evil, you know, the evil of those authorities that put him to death and the good and the triumph of God's plan over that small and petty evil. And this is such a life of contrasts we live in, you know, stark and existential contrasts. I mean, the good news is salvation, right? It's like we get to do this with God despite all the appearances of futility and death, et cetera, et cetera. What Jesus said was no. The reality is we go on, you go on. If you embrace God and love God, life becomes full of meaning instead of empty and futile. And that all culminates in this 3-day period, you know, where evil seemed to triumph and they killed him. And then 3 days later, he rose again, began appearing and declaring the good news. And what a drama of good and evil, you know, and the triumph of life over death. It's just such an amazing time.
Mm-hmm. Well, you know, when we look about what it's talking about in that paragraph that I read, you know, often it appears that slander, lies, dishonesty, and unrighteousness, sin, prevails. And it does appear like that often. But faith, after all, triumphs over evil, sin, and iniquity. And if only we can keep that faith, you know, in the face of what seems so unjust. And here is Jesus, you know, perhaps. And I was talking to our good friend John Hay yesterday. I said, you know, they call it Good Friday. And there's of all of the greatest injustice that ever happened on the planet, this was the greatest. There was nothing good about it, you know? And yet we call it good. Well, we guess we have to figure out something, right? And John said, yeah, I understand. It's because, you know, we believe, you know, that Christianity believes that Jesus, you know, died for their sins. That's why. And how it becomes about his death and not about his life. And why it ends up being called good. But it was the greatest injustice ever. And if the world is feeling like it's been treated unjustly, it can find a friend in Jesus, because he was as well. If the world feels misunderstood, the world has a friend in Jesus. And just like he said, I have overcome the world, and you can too. And I pray that everybody who's experienced the gross injustice of this world can just keep that peace, his peace. He overcame it, and we can too.
There's so much wrapped up in this period of time and the symbolism of what happened during that whole week leading up to his death, and then the triumph of the resurrection and the appearances that began to occur. One of the paragraphs I enjoy is in the midst of that drama, and it's not today, it's tomorrow in the sequence of things. It's the Sunday evening. you know, the rumors of Jesus' resurrection were beginning to spread throughout the entire city. They had no internet, but word of mouth in this situation was electrifying. It was immediate, almost immediately. People began to know things, you know, through the ether. And there's this paragraph, it's 190.3.3. And again, you know, what looks like is going on and what is really going on, that to me is one of the lessons here. It looks like they had the evil had triumphed. And it's sort of related to your paragraph that you read, Paula. And so they say, as a result of sending out the messengers during the mid-forenoon, this is Sunday, and from the unconscious leakage of intimations concerning this appearance of Jesus at Joseph's house, word began to come to the rulers of the Jews during the early evening that it was being reported about the city that Jesus had risen, and that many persons were claiming to have seen him. The Sanhedrists were thoroughly aroused by these rumors. After a hasty consultation with Annas, Caiaphas called a meeting of the Sanhedrin to convene at 8 o'clock that evening. It was at this meeting that action was taken to throw out of the synagogues any person who made mention of Jesus' resurrection. It was even suggested that anyone claiming to have seen him should be put to death. This proposal, however, did not come to a vote, since the meeting broke up in confusion bordering on actual panic. They had dared to think they were through with Jesus. They were about to discover that their real trouble with the man of Nazareth one had just begun. So it's like, what a shift of perceptions, you know, and the scene is so vivid of, you know, a city of a million people, and all they could think and talk about for that three-day period was what was happening in this drama. It was so electrifying.
Isn't that the truth? Imagine that. And it's lasted all these centuries, that story. As vivid now as it was then, and it spread through Jerusalem and all around the surrounding areas that he is risen. Such a simple message. You know, even the apostles.
What was the phrase they used at the beginning of that? Something being unconscious or what was that?
As a result of sending out the messengers during the mid-forenoon and from the unconscious leakage of intimations concerning this appearance of Jesus at Joseph's house.
Unconscious leakage.
Yeah.
Is that really what it says, unconscious leakage?
Yeah, people picked up on things. You know, they saw that people were acting differently and all kinds of things were going on in and around the scene. It's just, The ultimate triumph of truth and beauty and life, you know, eternal life over raw power and evil to just sort of manipulate things. It's what looks apparent in one situation in reality is illusory. You know, the evil.
Well. Such a beautiful thing, you know. It always leads me to that wonderful section, the two brothers at Emmaus, because Jesus is following along with them as they earnestly discuss these things, and he plays along with them. You know, it really shows that our Creator has a sense of humor, and he listens to what they have to say, and then he says, Well, can I enlighten you? Because I am more than familiar with this man.
Right.
You know, it's just such, and then he launches into this most eloquent, beautiful soliloquy, I don't know what you could call it, of who he is and why he came. And I always think of the shadow of a great rock in a weary land. And that one touches my heart because I can't take too much direct sunlight for too long. My skin's too fair, you know, and I feel like I'm being cooked after a while. So the shadow of a great rock is really a blessing to me. And I get that, the coolness of shade, the comfort, the protection it provides. That's really one of the great metaphors he uses. Oh, well, I could wax philosophically about how much I love Jesus all day, and I know you guys could, too.
we could take turns.
Yeah, we could take turns. I just wanted to do that little bit of Easter recognition and happiness. And it's a special holiday, you know. Not just about the bunny and eggs and all of that. The pagan rites of fertility or whatever, however that got woven in there. It's all for fun. It's all good. You know, it doesn't bother me. Some people take it very personally, but it's like, whatever. It's just, you know, it makes it fun for kids, although the real meaning sometimes gets lost, obviously.
What's interesting? Oh, sorry.
Go ahead, Chuck. Go.
Oh, well, I was just going to say one of the things that's interesting about what Jesus did in his bestowal was he fulfilled the kind of the third leg of the ministry that's offered. You know, the book talks about how we have this threefold endowment in spiritual ministry. We have the spirit of the Father, the Spirit of the Son, the Spirit of Truth, and the Spirit of the Spirit, which is the Holy Spirit. That's from 194:211. And by virtue of becoming a master son from this completion of this bestowal, that led to the release, of course, of the Spirit of Truth. So that we now have these three ministries in fullness. And that's kind of part of what that whole drama was about, was him, right, you know, completing his bestowal in accordance with the Father's will. And then pouring out of the Spirit of Truth that subsequently followed from that. But in the last paragraph, I mean, just leading into what we're reading, going to be reading today.
Yeah,
the last
I was just going to say.
The last paragraph of the preceding section, I think, is maybe worth reading again, or at least looking at. Yeah. Well, I'll just read it really quickly. It says, the ministering personality, this is the last paragraph of part six, or no, part four, says paper 113, says the ministering personality of the guardian angel, of the guardian seraphim, rather, the God presence of the indwelling adjuster, the circuited action of the Holy Spirit, and the Son consciousness of the Spirit of Truth are all divinely correlated into a meaningful unity of spiritual ministry and into a mortal personality. Though hailing from different sources and different levels, these celestial influences are integrated in the evolving and enveloping presence of the Supreme Being.
Right.
So here we have the guardian seraphim, you know, like we were reading about last week, you know, they coordinate, they correlate, and they cooperate. It's kind of the three C's of the ministry of the third source and center. And we can see that here, that's what they do for us. All these spirit ministries from these varied sources are made one. Are brought into a meaning, are correlated into a meaningful unity. That's how they put it, of spiritual ministry.
Into
a mortal personality. So this is pretty extraordinary, you know, what they're able to do.
Salvation. It is salvation because he opened this up to all of us. All of us have the possibilities to have this ministry in our lives. It wasn't possible for everyone before he came and then went to his Father.
Right.
When he went to the
right.
Father,
that's
he
right.
opened this all up to all of us,
right.
these potentials and possibilities.
This threefold ministry.
Yeah, right. The triad of ministry.
I wonder if I could just read one other thing that puts this kind of in a cosmic context. And I hadn't really noticed this or thought about this quite this way before, so hopefully you guys will find it interesting. This is from paper 56, part 3, paragraph 5 and 6, where, again, they're talking about this threefold ministry, but from kind of a little bit of a different perspective. They say here that perfected creature existence can be attained, sustained, and eternalized by the fusion of self-conscious mind with a fragment of the pre-Trinity spirit endowment of some one of the persons of the Paradise Trinity. So in our case, that would be the Father. But they're talking about the thought adjuster as being pre-Trinity. And then they say the mortal mind is the creation of the sons and daughters of the eternal Son in the infinite Spirit, and when fused with the thought adjuster from the Father, partakes of the threefold spirit endowment of the evolutionary realms. But these three spirit expressions become perfectly unified in the finaliters, even as they were in eternity, so unified in the universal I Am, ere he ever became the universal Father, the eternal Son, and the infinite Spirit. And then the next paragraph, they say, Spirit must always and ultimately become threefold in expression, and Trinity unified in final realization. Spirit originates from one source through a threefold expression, and in finality, it must and does attain its full realization in that divine unification which is experienced in finding God, oneness with divinity, in eternity, and by means of the ministry of the cosmic mind of the infinite expression of the eternal word of the Father's universal thought. Anyway, there's a lot in there. But that kind of is what they're talking about in the section we're about to read. That this is what the seraphim are helping us to do, is this reunification, this threefold, that spirit starts out as one, it goes through three, and then back to one again, in a sense.
But much better on the return trip. Much better once it gets, back to the Father with the ascended mortal potential finaliter who has, I guess, presumably reached supremacy in their own right.
Well, that's where it ties in with that last paragraph of the previous section, where this is all going toward, this all happens within the evolving presence of the Supreme Being.
Right.
Which is the next level of universal unity, in terms of, the completion of the evolving potentials of, spirit landing in a realm of imperfection.
Well,
yeah, isn't it amazing to think that that God sends out his spirit and that the whole universe then works to bring it back?
Yeah.
in a new and more meaningful, beautiful, complete way, experiential way. The whole universe is working in concert to accomplish that grand germination process. I don't know. It boggles my mind.
Yeah.
Sorry,
it does.
Go ahead.
What were the citations that you shared, Chuck? Those two paragraphs?
Those two paragraphs are from paper 56, part 3, paragraphs 5 and 6.
Great. I want to go look at those. There's so much detail in there. Actually really does correlate with the last sentence in section 4 of the paper we're reading, which is what caught me when you read it. When they say that though hailing from different sources and different levels, the celestial influences, meaning the influences of the three persons of the Trinity separately, the Father, Son, and Spirit, these celestial influences are all integrated in the, and the words they use are really interesting, in the enveloping and evolving presence of the Supreme Being. And the Supreme Being, what struck me was, in the paragraphs you read, they talk about the pre-Trinity manifestation of the three persons separately.
That struck me too.
And in the enveloping, you could almost think of the Supreme Being as post-Trinity, as the summation and the weaving back together in this universe age of these influences of the three separate persons of the Trinity back into a unified whole. Which is really, really related to what you were saying, Paula. It's really interesting stuff.
Once a finaliter has been embraced by the Trinity, do you think they're post-Trinity? I mean, that's the way I would think about
it. Well, I don't know if you could ever be post-Trinity, but you could a fulfillment, maybe.
Yeah.
Post-Trinity. Relatively.
There's lots of language that talks about sort of the segmentation of God's nature and we are manifestations of that in the sense that we are persons coming out of the original creator person, and that as finaliters we're somewhere along the stage, on the set of stages, that will move us through the supreme and then through the ultimate, and then eventually back to the absolute, where they imply that we will somehow be rejoined into the unity of the absolute, but without mm-hmm. losing our individuality, having traveled mm-hmm. all the way around the circle of eternity. and go figure that out, but mm-hmm. somehow there's a resolution of all of these differentiations that eventually make their way back to unity somehow. And I think finality status is just one stage of that. I actually think that in the age of the ultimate, we become transcendental beings, and then in the age of the absolute, something else happens.
I like to think about the joy of that embrace when, mm-hmm. you know, you finally made it. And, the joy of that embrace. Wow.
There's also a subtle distinction that, you know, those that become mighty messengers, they say, are Trinity embraced. And they say that in this universe age, they have achieved finality of destiny. They become seventh stage spirits. In a sense, they're finished for this year. But that's not the case for the finaliters. The finaliters aren't really finished as of this universe age until this universe age is fully completed, the supreme is fully realized, and we somehow go through a transmutation that merges our mind function in some fashion with that of the supreme, and we partake of all finite experience somehow while retaining our individuality. So go figure that out, and that's just at the culmination of this initial age, you know, just this age of the supreme. More to come.
We're watching future times here.
Some really really deep stuff. It's fun considering destiny that way. Mm-hmm. One of the things that's said in that regard is, perhaps in the same way that we received a thought adjuster at the beginning, we'll receive some portion, some mind endowment from the Supreme that effectively changes us from dual beings to triune beings in that sense. Mm. I mean, that's one speculation of one of the authors. And The other aspect that's interesting there is, you know, just to consider, you know, what it is we're going to be not only doing out there in outer space with all that experience, but, you know, how important it is garnering the experience that we do here. There are some other interesting aspects there, but let me turn it back to you guys.
Oh, sorry, guys.
Oh, wait a minute. Is that Avon calling?
One would think.
We are dating ourselves here, Andre.
We are definitely dating ourselves with Avon Fuller Brush.
You know,
Avalon calling?
Is it the Kirby vacuum cleaner salesman? Is it Encyclopedia Britannica?
Does anybody,
you know,
ring
Andre,
a doorbell anymore?
You gotta realize if there are any millennials, they understand nothing of what you've just said, Andre.
That's exactly right. I have no concept that could even occur. Yes, folks, people used to show up on your doorstep selling things.
You could shop from home.
There was no internet. Yeah.
Oh, wait, you can shop from home now. You just don't need somebody to come to your home to do it.
And you'd have like a 36-volume encyclopedia that would tell you everything instead of just pushing a button and looking at it on Google search, you know?
That's right.
So you had to have an encyclopedia, absolutely.
I remember it was a great boon to our household when my father, you know, who worked on a machinist salary, picked up a used set in probably 1964 of Wagnall's Encyclopedia, 1957 version. You know, so not even up to date, but it was that was a great thing to have compared to not having any encyclopedias in the household. And
yeah.
You can imagine I delved into that right away. I was a bookworm as a kid.
Mm.
I bet you like to read maps too.
Yeah. Oh yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Glenn is like
those encyclopedias were a lot of fun.
Oh, they were.
Crack it open anywhere and like, whoa. The whole world would open up.
Yeah.
And unabridged dictionaries as well. You know, big, thick, unabridged dictionaries. I mean, the way that I explored those was, you know, you go through, you look up the meanings, then you see where other words you don't know. You go look up those words. You look up those words. You see other words you don't know. You go look up those words. And you keep, you know, downstepping, you know, all the way through. And you start to see words recursing back to the original words as well, and learning about synonyms and learning about antonyms and learning about all those things. And that was just fascinating as a kid.
Mm-hmm. Good preparation for reading your answer book.
Yeah.
True.
No, seriously.
Yeah, the angels, they were working on me. They were working on me.
Yeah.
even my group guardians, they said, okay, there's a Urantia book on the planet. This kid might be a candidate. Let's see if we can put him through his paces. I'm sure they did that with all.
So here's a little bit of arcane conjecture, and you guys, you know, see if you want to play with this. We were talking in a previous discussion in the last week or so about how the adjusters, when you know a number of them volunteer to indwell each mortal, and they look at the plans of ancestry, and my assumption is that mortal has actually already been born, and they're, you know, like in the first year or two or so of age, and adjusters look at that, all the blueprint of who that human person is, and volunteer, and then they choose one, and they say they come with a full understanding of who that human being was and a plan for their progression. Do you think, I wonder, you know, and you know, the image, the scene that I can see is, you know, these adjusters are saying, and the one that gets to indwell us basically saying, I want that one. I want to be with that one. I want to try and accomplish eternity, destiny, and fuse with that little person, you know, in particular, I'm volunteering for that one. And I wondered, do you think that when they did that, for instance, when we were in that situation and our adjusters chose us, the Urantia book was around, right?
Yeah.
We were all born at a time where the Urantia book already
good
existed.
Point.
Do you think those adjusters said, you know, I think I could get this one to be interested in the revelation.
Yeah, absolutely. They can see that kind of thing. Yeah.
Absolutely. This
how many of
the
you?
Potential. Yeah.
How many Go of ahead, you Paula. Have thought if I didn't find it the way I did, I would have found it some other way?
Oh, I think so. Because
I do
if
too.
You look at our histories. Yeah. We were really asking the kinds of questions. I mean, I know, I remember back then I was saying, you know, I want to know what's going on. I want to know what's happening here. Show me what's going on here. I want to know. And
obviously
I'm,
something going on.
Yeah, and I'm convinced, you know, they knew where there were books on the shelf. They, in fact, I think about the angels and what they accomplish in our lives. And when I was in that, I was 17, I was in that metaphysical bookstore and someone came in to show the proprietor of the Urantia book and I was there stocking shelves and no one else was there. It was a little bookshop. And I wonder if that were the angels involved in bringing that person, you know, to that store. You know, you never know these things because that's the kind of stuff they do, you know, is they move things around in the environment in order to accomplish our spiritual growth. So there's just all these little fun questions that I'm going to have for up on the Mansion Worlds and say, so what was going on, guys? Tell me, please.
Or even this section we're about to read.
Yeah.
Is all about
good
that.
Segue,
oh, my goodness.
Chuck.
Good segue.
What a coincidence.
Good. Good job. That was very deft. Very deft.
Nice.
Excellent.
So, who wants to read section 5?
Teamwork. Teamwork.
Yeah.
Yeah, teamwork. Yeah. 1-2. Slam dunk there.
Oh, I can read it.
Do you want
to?
Okay.
Yeah.
Great.
Yeah, yeah. So, this is section 5 in paper 113 on the Guardian Angels. And the title of the section is Seraphic Ministry to Mortals.
And before you start, just keep in mind what you were just saying about how our adjuster arrives with a plan, a life plan for us.
Okay.
Yeah.
And they say that the ministry of the angels is somehow mysteriously coordinated with our adjusters. So
that's
something
that's
to keep in mind as we read this.
Yeah, these guys are very busy in the background in our lives. So they say, angels do not invade the sanctity of the human mind. They do not manipulate the will of mortals. Neither do they directly contact with the indwelling adjusters. The guardian of destiny influences you in every possible manner consistent with the dignity of your personality. Under no circumstances do these angels interfere with the free action of the human will. Neither angels nor any other order of universe personality have power or authority to curtail or abridge the prerogatives of human choosing. Angels are so near you and care so feelingly for you that they figuratively, quote, weep because of your willful intolerance and stubbornness, close quote. Seraphim do not shed physical tears. They do not have physical bodies, neither do they possess wings. But they do have spiritual emotions, and they do experience feelings and sentiments of a spiritual nature, which are in certain ways comparable to human emotions. The seraphim act in your behalf quite independent of your direct appeals. They are executing the mandates of their superiors, and thus they function regardless of your passing whims or changing moods. This does not imply that you may not make their tasks either easier or more difficult, but rather that angels are not directly concerned with your appeals or with your prayers. That's interesting. We'll have to come back to that one. In the life of the flesh, the intelligence of angels is not directly available to mortal men. They are not overlords or directors. They are simply guardians. The seraphim guard you. They do not seek directly to influence you. You must chart your own course, but these angels then act to make the best possible use of the course you have chosen. They do not ordinarily, arbitrarily intervene in the routine affairs of human life. But when they receive instructions from their superiors to perform some unusual exploit, you may rest assured that these guardians will find some means of carrying out these mandates. They do not, therefore, intrude into the picture of human drama except in emergencies, and then usually on the direct orders of their superiors. They are the beings who are going to follow you for many an age, and they are thus receiving an introduction to their future work and personality association. Seraphim are able to function as material ministers to human beings under certain circumstances, but their action in this capacity is very rare. They are able, with the assistance of the midway creatures and the physical controllers, to function in a wide range of activities in behalf of human beings, even to make actual contact with mankind. But such occurrences are very unusual. In most instances, the circumstances of the material realm proceed unaltered by seraphic action. Although occasions have risen involving jeopardy to vital links in the chain of human evolution, in which seraphic guardians have acted, and properly, on their own initiative.
Mm. What a section. I love this section.
Mm.
Mm. Yeah, a lot of stuff in there.
Okay,
does it answer more questions than it raises?
No, you know, I think it, I don't know, it might be equal. I've had some interesting conversations with people over the years about just even the first sentence, angels do not invade the sanctity of the human mind. I know some readers that the way they interpret that is, if you want to get their attention, you have to speak out loud to them. I don't think that's what that means.
No, I don't think so.
Yeah, I think that they're in the mental, you know, the mind circuits. I think if we direct our thoughts to them, they know our thoughts. But then we've directed them toward them. You know, I don't think you have to speak out loud to have an angel hear
mm-hmm.
you.
Mm-hmm.
But that's just one interpretation, you know. For me, the most important thing in this section that has changed my life, honestly, is this, and it's a thread throughout the book, but that they don't influence you or try to coerce you to make a decision. They help you make the most of the decision you do make. And that has just, in my life, proven invaluable, because so often when you're grappling with a really hard decision, you know, it just seems like it's so black and white and it could go either way. But most often they're both, you know, whatever decision you make, it's an uphill climb. It's fraught with difficulty and reward, and they'll help you make the most of it. So you don't have to agonize about it so much. Just choose and go. And they'll help you make the most of it. I love that. It takes so much of the anxiety away.
I think in somewhere else, I don't know if we've read this already, they talk about how they can reinforce certain
thoughts. I was looking for that. They highlight, they reinforce some of our thoughts, the things that are progressive. And I couldn't find it. Maybe some one of you can find it. And I always think of it like they're working inside and in around our minds with a yellow highlighter, and they're saying, ooh, that's a good one. Let's raise that one. Stick with that guys. Stick with that one.
That's what we do with our book.
Yeah,
you realize you'd underline the whole thing eventually, but
yeah, they highlight, they emphasize, you know, and so that's been a helpful metaphor for me. And it's at the beginning of section four. They say seraphim are mind stimulators. They continually seek to promote circle making decisions in the human mind. So they don't introduce things and say, all right, now think about this. But they're working in our mental environment, and they can make things more prominent or strike us with the importance of certain things with a sort of, you know, somehow they can emphasize or highlight is how I think of them working. There's lots of interesting stuff in this section, and some puzzles too, I think. Where they say, oh, I'm sorry. Well, anyways, some of the other thoughts. Well, I'll find it. I'm looking for something in particular.
You know, that reinforced thing, it must be a different word.
Could be, because in paper 111 it says, during the life in the flesh, the evolving soul is enabled to reinforce the supermaterial decisions
right.
of the mortal
right.
mind.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's something different.
So, yeah, that's something different. And that's the only one that looks like it would be, you know, in that vein you were talking about.
Right.
Yeah.
The Mandela effect, once again. No, just kidding.
Yeah.
Because was reinforced.
Yeah.
Well, and there's this sentence in the second to last paragraph. The seraphim guard you. They do not seek directly to influence you.
Right.
Well, you know, I wonder, because they are trying to highlight things. So it's subtlety here. They say you must chart your own course, but these angels then act to make the best possible use of the course you have chosen.
See, that was what I was referring to.
Yeah.
My comment was about that. Yeah.
So they're doing everything, you know, in conjunction with your will. They're honoring your will. You've made choices. If you've made certain choices already, and you're clearly open to certain things, then they're going to honor that. Otherwise, it would be senseless to say, tempt not your angels to lead you in troublous ways. What?
Right.
You know? The idea being that, you know, they are always looking to help educate us. They're not going to educate us against our will, but where we have opened ourselves up to that, well, they say, well, good for you. How about this? Oh, didn't think the education was going to come in that form necessarily, but you know, that's how they work with us, you know, partly. Oh. And sometimes we can expect it, you know, the kind of environmental changes that we, you know, might see in front of us. Sometimes it's completely unexpected.
Well, I mean, let's take a real life example that for me is obviously was a turning point for me, you know. But here I am. I'm a 17-year-old high school kid, right? And you know, I'm in Los Angeles, and it's like new age hippie times, and all kinds of things are going on. And there are metaphysical bookshops here, there, and everywhere throughout the L.A. area. And I'm working a high school job in one of these bookshops, and it's a weekend day. And I've asked this question. They know, the angels know, that in my mind, I really want to understand the big picture, you know. I see all this stuff in the world, and I really want to understand. And this guy walks in, and he's got this big blue book, and he goes up to the proprietor who's behind the counter, and he says, hey, I wanted to just show you this, you know. And he starts flipping through the table of contents, and they're both looking at it. And to hear this 17-year-old kid just kind of comes up, doesn't want to intrude, and is just looking over their shoulder and looking at he's flipping through the pages, looking through the table of contents, and he's going, and I've been reading stuff about metaphysics and searching for the last year because I worked in this bookshop, and inwardly my jaw is dropping. You know, I'm going, oh my God, I can't believe what I'm looking at here. It, you know, I didn't understand most of it, but I knew that it was responding somehow to this big question mark that I had. So do you think the angels, like when that guy got up that morning and said, I think I'll go wander down to see Warren at the bookshop, you know, and show him this thing I ran into, this UB. Do you think the angels are in coordination and saying, you know, we got this kid at the bookshop. let's expose him to this and see if he bites, you know? And that's very much in keeping with my desires. I mean, I've made the choice I want to find out, right? And I'm not talking about that kind of circumstance. And I do think those are the kinds of things that the angels do. They're working among us and between us, they say, in our social environment, and they nudge a little here, they nudge a little there, where people are cooperative, and they help things to happen that we would like to have happen, but that we have no clue are possible. Mm-hmm. They know, and they're arranging things for the good.
And I found that quote. speaks to what you're talking about. Yeah, it was intensify, not reinforce. Anyway,
they
say that the master seraphim of planetary supervision utilize many agencies for the prosecution of their missions. So who knows? Maybe we're figure into their
one of their agencies. Yeah.
Yeah. Right.
Well, what else do they have?
They function as
they're not talking about dogs and cats.
Oh, okay. True. Well, I don't know. I wonder about our cat sometimes. Anyway.
Yeah.
It says they function as ideational clearinghouses, mind focalizers, and project promoters. So think about the Erasure book being on, having been released on the planet as a project. They definitely keen on that one. It says, while unable to inject new and higher conceptions into human minds, they often act to intensify some higher ideal which has already appeared within a human intellect. So that sounds like you, Marvin. You are like that desire.
Yeah.
I mean, I experienced that too, pretty much the same way.
Me too.
We all did. We all did. Yeah, that big question, what the F is really going on?
Well, I think I told you, I told God he's going to have to reveal himself to me. I told him straight up when I was 16, you're going to have to reveal yourself to me because I'm not getting involved with any more religions.
Okay, well, here's a whole book about me.
Yeah. Blew my mind.
Sure. Yeah. What was the citation again, Chuck? On
that? That's paper 114. Actually, it's the same paper.
Okay.
Oh, no, it isn't.
Coming up.
No, this is
the next paper, yeah.
Seraphic Planetary
Government. Seraphic Planetary Government. Yeah, it's 114.619.
619.
Right.
Okay.
Yeah.
Yeah, I knew there was language in there along those lines, and that was the emphasis I was looking for. Is, they take what's already there and they're underlining and they're highlighting and they're bringing it to prominence. And I also think, sometimes you have that experience where you've got a thought that keeps on reoccurring, kind of won't let you go,
Yeah.
And I think that's also sort of angelic kind of ministry. They say, hey, pay attention here. Come on. Don't be so distracted. Look at this. Look at this. Keep this in front of you.
curiosity, too, about higher things.
Mm-hmm.
It can be nagging in that same way, and I think that's sponsored in some way. And maybe that's more of an adjuster thing. I don't know, but we're just, persistently curious.
I gotta say this. I think there are lots of misconceptions and misattributions that are just part of our culture as to what it is that the angels are busy with and what they're concerned with. Things like, when we say it humorously, things like getting me a parking space, when I'm looking for a parking space. The parking angels. I don't think they're concerned with those realities, the mundane realities of life. I think they're there trying to accomplish the same thing the adjuster is, which is to really evolve our souls to the point and grow our relationship with God within and to higher values of truth and beauty and goodness to the point where we are survivable as an embryonic Marantia soul. They're trying to grow us spiritually. That's what they're preoccupied with, I think, and anything that relates to that.
Right. Didn't we just read about circle making decisions?
Yeah, exactly. So I think that's what they're busy with, really, the majority of the time.
But they are interacting with you as you are right now in this moment. They're like the hands-on, You think of sometimes I think about the basic feminine and masculine ways of dealing with things. And angels, the Urantia book tells us that angels are more the feminine side, more the daughters of God. And men and women, for instance, just take one profession like medicine. A doctor diagnoses and prescribes, but a nurse puts their hands on you. A nurse makes that prescription feasible, practical, real. And that's the way I look at angels, you know, the grand, you know, they are the ministers, the ones like nurses who actually get involved with you on a very real and personal level. They know your daily doings. They're, you know, it says they're going to be with you for a good long time. They are the beings who are going to follow you for many an age. And they are an introduction to the future work. Go ahead, Chuck.
I was just saying, we know they have a sense of humor, too.
Oh, yeah. But they also feel. They feel for you, you know.
Right.
And I think, how is it that, you know, they're able to act on your behalf? It says they don't always manipulate the physical environment, but sometimes they do. Sometimes they must. And I think, okay, so how do they do that? How do they know an accident is going to happen today? Well, we know from the motive that blind and unforeseen accidents do not occur in the cosmos. Okay, that's interesting. Because how is that? How is that possible that blind and unforeseen accidents do not occur in the cosmos? But I take them at their word, they don't. And then it says, neither does the higher being assist the lower being who refuses to act on their own light of truth. So then that tells me that an angel or some other higher being could assist and prevent that accident if they deemed that it was necessary or advisable. And so, you know, it's just interesting the level of engagement that they're at. And I don't think they help you find parking spots. It's kind of a funny ha-ha when you go, oh, the parking angels are with me today. You know, but there's days when they're not with you, especially in Boulder, and it's very frustrating.
Right, for sure.
Boulder parking, although no Boulder end of parking frustrating. Is as bad as it used to be. I'm sure it will be now that people are getting vaccinated. It'll be, get
yeah,
bad again.
True.
So.
That was one of the delightful things about the pandemic, the lack of traffic problems. But
you know, disaster avoidance is one thing, but this quote we just read, it says they often act to intensify some higher ideal which has already appeared. And to me, that's kind of maybe the more significant, or at least equally significant aspect of their ministry. And the same question comes up, though. It's like, how do they do that? How do often act to intensify some higher ideal? But have any of you ever had that feeling? Sometimes you get an insight or a realization or maybe the birth of a higher ideal about some question or something. You just kind of get a feeling inside where there's an emotional wave that sweeps through or something.
You know, part of
an intensity.
I really associate that with what we call intuitions, intuitive sensings. And part of what you read, I'm pretty sure, I don't have it in front of me, Chuck, but part of what you read had implications for coordinating teamwork, bringing people together
absolutely.
And helping them work together. Yeah. And
Promoters.
Yeah, and I think there's a tremendous amount of what we call intuition in how that works when it's working well. That is it's sort of beyond what we're focusing on or paying attention to, but it does feel like there are elements of coordination going on in and around it.
The social architect.
When people are drawn together to work together, especially to service kinds of things, it feels like there's a lot of stuff going on, nuances that are going on in and around and under the surface. And I just think a lot of that is angelic support.
So what if they run a dating service?
Well, imagine. Well, I can tell you they do.
Oh, yeah? Okay.
Yeah. I made that prayer, and they, you know, help. Because they're I think they deal in the realm of human interactions.
Yeah.
That's
well,
the main
outcome.
Fabric that they weave. And, if you ask, if you know what you're asking for, it's good to be very specific. And, Yeah, but, you know, it's interesting to me to think you mentioned the social architects. Chuck and I had just looked that quote up. And then what occurs to me is we're talking about the Guardians of Destiny. That's one function, right? And it's like this section we just read said they guard you. You know, it even, that's in italics, that word guard, that seraphim guard you, right? But then think about all the other seraphic agencies that they might have to interact with, like, for instance, the social architects. Or if we happen to be working in the next paper, the planetary government, the seraphic planetary government, we learn that we are working with other basic cores of angels too, and because we might be guided to work with the angels of home life or the angels of, you know, the races or some other organized group of angels on another level on a big project that they are working on. Even still, our seraphim, our guardians are guarding us within that realm. And so there's these multiple layers of seraphim all working on various things, and we interact, and our angels interact with probably many of them, especially if we're oriented towards some grand project. Or even capable of being oriented towards some grand project on a planetary scale of a greater destiny, let alone, say, our own personal destiny, which is what they're guarding. They're guarding our destiny to get to paradise.
Yeah. Well, you know? They say you must chart your own course. You must chart your own course. There's a lot wrapped up in that. I mean, imagine being dropped on a rebellion planet and being told, look, you got to chart your own course.
Yeah.
You know? I mean, that's kind of the situation we're in. It makes it even, you know, more challenging, but intriguing and fascinating at the same time. I mean, in a normal world, maybe you just, like, go downtown and say, okay, where do I fit in? You know, and they'll find a place for you or something. I don't know. Maybe not, but I just feel like living on a rebellion planet requires a lot more initiative, a lot more inner searching and making decisions for yourself. Because if you allow too much external influence over your decisions, you know, you might get some bad stuff in there that's not going to be for the well-being of anybody. So having that inner check, yeah.
Do you ever wonder about the randomness of your life in some ways? I mean, I just have to share an example of this, which I reflect. I don't know. I wake up in the middle of the night and start thinking about stuff like this. You know, me and my friend Janine, again, when I was 15, were walking down the street, walking towards the shopping center in my neighborhood, Bear Valley, which is a southwest suburb of Denver. And a guy drove by on a motorcycle, and she whistled at him. And he went down the street a ways and turned back around and came back up and started flirting with her. That guy introduced me to my first husband.
Huh.
And I have two children with that man. That whistle changed my life.
Wow.
It changed
crazy.
My life. That whistle. She whistled. He turned around and came back. They became friends. He introduced me to my first husband, who, as you know, my late husband. He died in 1982. I was a widow with two little children. But that whistle that my girlfriend, Janine, who was a flirt, made changed my life.
Here's a question.
That's crazy.
If you're asking yourself, you know, when they say you must chart your own course, but the angels, and I'm assuming the thought adjusters, work to make the best use of that course, right? If you work with that as a principle here, and let's take the story you have, Paula. As I've thought about how these agencies work in us, jester, spirit of truth, and and the angels, the third source persons. I keep coming back to the statements where they say the main thing that's happening in this life is the formation of your soul. And more I'm of the opinion that we chart the things like the whistle and who you meet and what happens and who you're attracted to and who you marry are all matters that we chart, that are part of the course we chart. And what they're busy with is making use of every experience in our lives to stimulate value-laden decisions, make choices, and grow our embryonic souls so that our souls are viable in the next life, and that's what they're primarily preoccupied with. And indeed, they say that about the adjusters. That's exactly what the adjuster is primarily preoccupied with. So I have to wonder whether the particulars of our lives are not really the stuff that they're really working so much with, as much as they take those particulars and the value conclusions and the moral choices and the soul-forming implications of all of these choices, and they're busy forming us in this life for the next life. And that has helped me understand all these seemingly contradictory statements where they say they're not so much concerned with the details of your lives as with how you make your decisions. And, you know, it's the soul formation that's going on from their perception. And the particulars are really the raw material that they use for that purpose. So I don't know what you all think about that.
Well, there's a type of randomness about that. And I think that randomness is essential. I really do. I think that's like the cards you're dealt, or the, you know, you don't get to choose the cards you're dealt. You do get to choose how you play them, though.
Exactly.
You know? And
so in other words, you might have married this person or you might have married that person. And obviously that feels very important to us. But what they're concerned about is, how did you make that choice? And when you woke up on that morning and you had that kid and you decided, you know, to pick that kid up and nurture them despite the fact that you were really tired and irritable, what they're concerned with is, what value is that to Paula's soul? And how do I lodge that value in her soul so that her soul develops more and she has those value realizations as part of her character in the next life? And the particulars are relevant, but they could have happened other ways as well.
Oh, sure. Absolutely. And would have. They could have and would have. The outcomes might have been different, but not significantly so. You know, I had already made the choice in my life that I wanted to be a mom. So somebody was going to be the father of my children. It, you know, it was a foregone conclusion in my mind. It was just a matter of when, you know. But it is interesting.
Yeah. Well, when they say that we have to chart our own course, you know, in the choosing of our course, we can only choose from the available options that have thus far been conceived in our minds and been presented externally through the environment. So in a way, even though they're saying that we have to choose our own course, they could easily have some influence on what options occur to us in terms of that course. But
it's interesting too
to think about what they say about the adjuster trying to give us picturizations of destiny. That idea that the adjuster is working from within to give us, to awaken these, picturizations is what they call them. They're almost like imaginings of possibility, of a higher nature, right? It's like imagining yourself as a parent with kids. I mean, that's a picturization of destiny in a sense. And if it's vivid and if it's strong, and then it becomes a real desire in your heart and your mind, and you know, you can do whatever it takes to make it happen. In a way, that's a choosing your own course, but it's a course that's been intensified or highlighted in some way, maybe both by the adjuster and the seraphim. Who knows? But it's so intriguing, this this idea that we have internal and external inputs, you might say.
Mm-hmm. Right, and how they intersect and how they work together.
Into, or even our just our imagining. Even our imagining of what's possible. You know,
right.
When you get a new realization, it's like you put this together with that and you think about something else and, you know, you realize something about yourself and what you like to do and what your talents and abilities are. And then maybe a whole new picture comes into your mind. About, wow, I could be doing that, you know, kind of.
Yeah,
thing.
You know, Viktor Frankl said that the people... The people that survived the concentration camp were the ones that could imagine themselves beyond it. In his experience, the people that did better through the tough, the worst possible time were the ones that could imagine an end to it and imagine themselves beyond it. And I just heard that again from a kid who was arrested at 13 for shooting somebody in an armed robbery and spent 18 years in solitary confinement. And he's now been released and he's written a book. And he said the way he got through that was imagining himself free, imagining himself with his family, imagining, you know, it's interesting. 18 years of solitary confinement.
Wow.
And the guy's sane, you know,
yeah,
and he got through it by imagining himself in another circumstance. So, yeah, that's really important distinction, I think, Chuck, what we can imagine and we do bring into a reality.
Yeah, it can have a powerful influence.
Yeah.
Even if you're not in a concentration camp or a solitary confinement.
Well, yeah, because we're all in difficult situations at some point or another.
We all have,
you know,
solitary confinement of our own. Existence.
Yeah, if we can imagine ourselves through that, but you know, and maybe they work with that. Maybe the angels can work with that imagining.
Of course, we're never really alone, even when we're alone. So that's comforting.
Yeah, you're never really alone.
Yeah.
Well, that's
you
such
know,
a great
I,
section. Yeah, go ahead, Mom.
Yeah, let me, if you guys don't mind, let me share a couple of things that they sort of relate. They're back in the adjuster papers, but they really are quite related to what we've been reading and the questions we're talking about. Speaking of the thought adjusters, they say they labor with a material mind for the purpose of constructing by adjustment and spiritualization a new mind for the new worlds and the new name of your future career. Their mission chiefly concerns the future life, not this life. They are concerned in making your life reasonably difficult and rugged so that decisions will be stimulated and multiplied, which is interesting. And then a little further on, sorry. This is 10865. These faithful custodians of the future career unfailingly duplicate every mental creation with a spiritual counterpart. They are thus slowly and surely recreating you as you really are, only spiritually, for resurrection on the survival worlds. And all of these exquisite spirit recreations are being preserved in the emerging reality of your evolving and immortal soul, your mirage self. These realities are actually there, notwithstanding that the adjuster is seldom able to exalt these duplicate creations sufficiently to exhibit them to the light of consciousness.
Hmm.
So, you know, the image I have, We're very self-centered little beings. We're very preoccupied with the stuff of our lives and the drama of our decisions. And I think those are real. But I think what they're busy with and what the angels are busy with is helping support them. In addition to accomplishing good things in this life and in the world, they're really busy about embryonically forming us for the future life and for the future journey that they will accompany us on into eternity. And that's hard for us to keep front and center. I think we tend to be preoccupied with what's in front of us, sensorily and exteriorly. And we don't realize that the thing that's happening primarily is we're being formed in the womb of this existence for a future birth. So it's helpful, I think, to keep that emphasis there on the sidelines and just return to it periodically for me. Anyways.
That's keeping a long-distance view, right? Keeping the long-distance view of your career, which goes beyond this world. And it is hard to keep in mind when you're faced with problems in your daily life, you know, that have to be solved and require your immediate attention. It's easy to get wrapped up in the day.
Yeah.
You know, but Jesus said that too. You know, he said something like, sufficient unto the day are the troubles thereof. Be not anxious for tomorrow. And in some respects, you know, the decisions you make every day, day by day, are affecting every tomorrow. And so, you know, just make good decisions, the best decisions you feel you can make in the moment, and the rest will take care of itself.
Well, it's almost as if, you know, this life is very real, and it is real to us, and it has import, and we feel it deeply, and we need to do the best we can with it. But it's almost like all of it is raw material for them to use to make us, to form us in this life for the future life. So it's like it's happening on two levels simultaneously is one way to understand it.
Yeah.
The way we perceive it and the way the thought adjuster and the angels perceive it.
Well, they kind of sum it up when they say that what you are today is not so important as what you are becoming day by day.
Day by day and in eternity.
Yeah, there's another place I'm not able to find it, but where they talk about even with this life, the important thing is just that we have the experience of this life.
Right.
And that's the main, that's what's really important going forward, and even more so than what we actually do or accomplish. Just the fact
it
that we have this
to me
experience.
So much. Lately, how short this life is.
I know.
You know,
even
how
when we have
brief.
A full life. Like,
yeah.
Right?
It helps us age a little bit, doesn't it? To realize the
Yeah, it does. Yes, it does help. It keeps it in a relative perspective, doesn't it?
Yeah, it does.
True, you know. And the last 15 years has gone by so fast for me. That
yeah.
It's like, wow. Okay. But,
I can hardly keep up. I can hardly measure the weeks anymore. The weeks just spin by.
I know. Yeah.
Especially working from home and doing that kind of thing. It's like a complete time bubble. And then it doesn't help to, you know, have lived this long on Earth so that time units get progressively shorter and shorter. I mean, it's practically 2 week blocks that I measure. Here I am. I was looking forward, you know, to a time that I would be moving from Boulder County to Adams County now, and you know, goodness gracious, here I am. this is my moving month, and bang, it's right here.
Now the rubber hits the road.
Yeah.
Well,
just like
I found
that.
This.
Marvin, found it?
Yeah, I found this quote I was looking for. This is comes up in their discussion of the quickeners of morality, quickeners, which is a type of seraphim. And they say here that this is 39:4-13. They say, to the inhabited worlds, the quickeners of morality portray mortal life as an unbroken chain of many links. Your short sojourn, say that 100 times, your short sojourn on the sphere of mortal infancy is only a single link, the very first in the long chain that is to stretch across universes and through the eternal ages. It is not so much what you learn in this first life It is the experience of living this life that is important. Even the work of this world, paramount though it is not nearly so important as the way in which you do this work. So that ties in with what you guys were saying about character development going forward. There is no material reward for righteous living, but there is profound satisfaction, consciousness of achievement, and this transcends any conceivable material reward. Anyway, but that idea that it's not even so much that what we do is just the fact that we experience this life.
Yeah.
So that's the real tragedy for people who, you know, for one reason or another, die young before they have a full experience of this life.
I think of the midwayers saying, you know, eloquent descriptions of things beautiful can never thrill like the sight thereof. Nothing, Jesus called experience the master teacher. Nothing can replace it. The actual experience of something. So that makes total sense to me. But go ahead, Marvin, what were you going to say?
Well, it's helpful for me, and what you shared, Chuck, is right on target, that it's helpful for me to ask myself the question, and, you know, maybe it's helpful for others as well, to ask myself this question, and that is not really looking at all of the particular experiences I've had in my life, you know, just sort of moving, stepping aside from that and asking myself the question, how have all of the stages and events of my life formed me?
Mm.
And who am I now? When I think character, you know, soul.
Mm-hmm.
Who am I as a result of the cumulative choices? Who are we as a result of the cumulative choices we've made over decades and over this whole life? How have we been formed, and how are we now different in nature than we were 30, 40, 50 years ago? And that is the bigger picture of what they're trying to accomplish in us, so that when we're born, again, I get so much mileage out of this embryo metaphor. It's a huge difference for an embryo in the womb to be born at 6 months in duration versus 9 months, right?
Oh, right.
Just 3 months, but that little being is not sufficiently formed to survive without tremendous support and aid for the next 3 months in the intensive care nursery until it can function on its own. It's viable, right?
Mm.
That's kind of what's happening for us in this life. We are being formed spiritually, morontially, sufficient to function in the next life. And all of the particulars of what we go through, which we think are so important, they are important, but only relatively. What's really important is the formative process that results in our coming full term spiritually, so that when we're born in the next life, we can function. And they have a working, viable little being that they can work with. That's how I think they see it.
Good metaphor. I love that metaphor. It works for me, too, really, really well. And when you said that, I thought of the Mansion Worlds as the neonatal intensive care nursery.
Oh, exactly. No, Paula, as a matter of fact, let's take it just a little further. If you think of on the spheres of light and life, a 400-500-year lifespan culminating in fusion, right? I actually think they think of full birth as a spiritual being in the universe as when we fuse, right?
Mm-hmm.
That's when they say we become a permanent person, a survivable permanent
full
person
fledged.
In the universe. Fully formed, ready to go. That person now will proceed in the universe. Up until then, we are transient and temporary, and we are still being formed. So I think this life and all of the mental worlds up until fusion are really still the Melancha formative process of forming us. And then we're, in a sense, really fully born when we fuse as a spirit, as a potential spirit being in the universes. And that on a normal, you know, on a really highly evolved world, that's a 400 or 500 year process, and as you put it, it's exactly right. We're born prematurely into the mansion mm-hmm. world experience, and mm-hmm. we're in the ICU of those mansion worlds until we fuse, and then we're viable in the universe. Is how I've come to see it.
Yeah.
Oh
yeah.
Boy, preemies.
I thought
I was working so hard.
No.
Well, we are.
Well, Jesus speaks to this. Oh.
Well, I was going to say this is a great segue into the next section, which is the guardian angels after death, because that's what we're talking about. But go ahead and say what if you have a cross reference, Chuck, and then we'll read section 6.
Okay.
I think we can get it in.
Well, I just think it's really sweet the way Jesus talks about this. The same thing that we're talking, our kind of our embryonic state as we're going forward. This is from paper 147, part 5. He's having some conversations with the apostles. Starting with paragraph 7, he says, "That same evening, Jesus made the long-to-be-remembered address to the apostles regarding the relative value of status with God and progress in the eternal ascent to paradise. Said Jesus, 'My children, if there exists a true and living connection between the child and the Father, the child is certain to progress continuously toward the Father's ideals. True, the child may at first make slow progress, but the progress is nonetheless sure. The important thing is not the rapidity of your progress, but rather its certainty. Your actual achievement is not so important as the fact that the direction of your progress is Godward. What you are becoming day by day is of infinitely more importance than what you are today.'" And then just kind of skipping down to the ending of a couple things at the end of the next paragraph, he says, "Some of you may not stand high in actual levels of soul and spirit, but you are making daily progress on the living way, opened up through faith to God. There are tremendous possibilities in each of you for the future. Better by far to have a small but living and growing faith than to be possessed of a great intellect with its dead stores of worldly wisdom and spiritual unbelief."
Beautiful.
Yeah, I like
Thank
that.
Thank you. Yeah.
So even little baby steps, if you're in the right direction, that's what really matters.
Long to be remembered indeed.
Yeah, right. I love when they say that.
Like
long
everything
to
he ever said.
Yeah, right.
Oh, that was wonderful, Chuck. Thank you.
Anyway, it's very comforting, reassurance.
Yeah. This is, again, a thread that goes throughout the whole book. It's not so important as what you are today as what you are becoming. And they say it in many different ways. But I can't help but think of the analogy, again, of the preemie and every mother that carries a child and faces the risk of miscarriage, how each day mm-hmm. is vital. Every single day of that 9 months is a celebration. I made it another day. I made it another week. Every week we're closer to having a healthy child. And so, many, many a mother has laid on her back for months to ensure that child is born. And I think of the angels and all of the agencies of our Heavenly Father are like that, willing to do whatever it takes to ensure we get there. We can't fail if we want to go. And I think that's what Jesus was saying. Yeah. To have that living connection with the source that's taking us, we won't fail. It may take longer mm-hmm. or shorter. Doesn't matter. It's not important how long it takes. What's important is that we're faced in that direction and we're moving toward it.
Exactly.
Shall I take us through section 6?
Yes, please. That would be awesome.
Sounds great.
Yeah.
Okay. Guardian angels after death. Having told you something of the ministry of seraphim during natural life, I will endeavor to inform you about the conduct of the Guardians of Destiny at the time of the mortal dissolution of their human associates. Upon your death, your records, identity specifications, and the Marantia entity of the human soul, conjointly evolved by the Ministry of Mortal Mind and the Divine Adjuster, are faithfully conserved by the Destiny Guardian, together with all other values related to your future existence. Everything that constitutes you, the real you, except the identity of continuing existence represented by the departing adjuster, and the actuality of personality. The instant the pilot light in the human mind disappears, the spirit luminosity which seraphim associate with the presence of the adjuster, the attending angel reports in person to the commanding angels successively of the group, company, battalion, unit, legion, and host. And after being duly registered for the final adventure of time and space, such an angel receives certification by the planetary chief of seraphim for reporting to the evening star, or other lieutenant of Gabriel, in command of the seraphic army of this candidate for universe ascension. And upon being granted permission from the commander of this highest organizational unit, such a guardian of destiny proceeds to the first mansion world and there awaits the consciousizing of her former ward in the flesh. In case the human soul fails of survival after having received the assignment of a personal angel, the attending seraphim must proceed to the headquarters of the local universe, there to witness to the complete records of her complement as previously reported. Next, she goes before the tribunals of the archangels to be absolved from blame in the matter of the survival failure of her subject. And then she goes back to the worlds, again, to be assigned to another mortal of ascending potentiality or to some other division of seraphic ministry. But angels minister to evolutionary creatures in many ways aside from the services of personal and group guardianship. Personal guardians whose subjects do not go immediately to the mansion worlds do not tarry there in idleness awaiting the dispensational roll calls of judgment. They are reassigned to numerous ministering missions throughout the universe. The guardian seraphim is the custodial trustee of the survival values of mortal man's slumbering soul, as the absent adjuster is the identity of such an immortal universe being. When these two collaborate in the resurrection halls of Mansonia in conjunction with the newly fabricated Marantia form, there occurs the reassembly of the constituent factors of the personality of the mortal ascender. The adjuster will identify you. The guardian seraphim will repersonalize you and then represent you to the faithful monitor of your earth days. And even so, when a planetary age ends, when those in the lower circles of mortal achievement are foregathered, it is their group guardians who reassembled them in the resurrection halls of the mansion spheres, even as your record tells. And he shall send his angels with a great voice and shall gather together his elect from one end of the realm to another. The technique of justice demands that personal or group guardians shall respond to the dispensational roll call in behalf of all non-surviving personalities. The adjusters of such non-survivors do not return. And when the rolls are called, the seraphim respond, but the adjusters make no answer. This constitutes the resurrection of the unjust. In reality, the formal recognition of the cessation of creature existence. This roll call of justice always immediately follows the roll call of mercy, the resurrection of the sleeping survivors. But these are matters which are of concern to none but the supreme and all-knowing judges of survival values. Such problems of adjudication do not really concern us. Group guardians may serve on a planet age after age and eventually become custodians of the slumbering souls of thousands upon thousands of sleeping survivors. They can so serve on many different worlds in a given system, since the resurrection response occurs on the mansion worlds. All personal and group guardians in the system of Satania who went astray in the Lucifer Rebellion, notwithstanding that many sincerely repented of their folly, are to be detained on Gerasim until the final adjudication of the rebellion. Already have the universal censors arbitrarily taken from these disobedient and unfaithful guardians all aspects of their soul trusts and lodged these Marantia realities for safekeeping in the custody of volunteer Sekhanafim. Well, that's an interesting one for me, that last paragraph.
I know. I was going to say it's interesting that they put it in there, right there.
Well, it's not only interesting that they put it in there, it's interesting in that it presents a little bit of a conundrum and one that is hard of human understanding. And what's hard of human understanding is, why already have the universal censors arbitrarily taken from these disobedient and unfaithful guardians? Are they saying that they were unable to do so during the entire pre-sovereignty era, okay, of Michael, to dislodge these souls from these disobedient ones, and that in effect these mortals who were, you know, under group guardianship during that previous dispensation missed a dispensational resurrection, and not only one, but maybe two, because the rebellion happened 200,000 years ago, and we've had two dispensations since then. So that's a very, very read between the lines unusual aspect of something being revealed to us. Reading between the lines, all of a sudden you realize, wait a minute, these are in the safekeeping of volunteer Sekhanafim. They haven't risen yet. These mortals are going to have a very unusual resurrection indeed.
Mm-hmm.
So I don't understand, Andre, what makes you think that these responsibilities weren't taken from these particular seraphim. You know, they say that, wasn't it for 7 long years, the rebels held forth and everyone, before any overt action occurred, but at the end of that 7-year period, Lucifer and Caligastia and all were free to continue to perpetrate their philosophy, but my recollection is they were essentially relieved of their responsibilities of leadership, all of them, and they were free to hold forth, but replacements came to take over their responsibilities in the universes, if I'm remembering correctly. So why wouldn't the Seraphim have been relieved of their responsibility pretty soon after the initiation of the rebellion? They might have been free, but their responsibilities were taken from them.
I'm in complete agreement with you, Marvin. That's a wonderfully astute thing to point out. But I would posit back the question to you, why are they referring to this in the present tense? Why are they referring to us already have these the universal censors arbitrarily taken from these disobedient and unfaithful guardians? Okay, that could have been at any particular time, but this is the telling thing. And unfaithful to all aspects of their soul trust, and lodge these Marantia realities for safekeeping in the custody of volunteer Sekhanafim. Why not indicate that this was a past transaction and that this is finished, as opposed to giving us the ambiguity here that this could still be the case in the present tense?
Hmm.
I'll have to chat with you about it. This looks to me like the whole sentence was in the past tense, but we're talking.
Really?
We're talking,
where's the past
that
tense?
That use of the
than...
word already, that already is seems almost like a kind of a literary device. I mean, meaning that it's happened. I mean, already is.
Yeah, it's happened. It's happened in the past. Already have the universe.
It already
could
have. It could have, but
yeah.
I'm curious as to why they left this last clause, lodged these Marantia realities for safekeeping in the custody of Volunteer Sakonafim. You know, why leave it there?
So do you not see
where I'm coming from?
I'm probably missing something. When they say already have, which is past tense, also refers to lodged. That also happened back at that same time.
Well,
okay,
yeah, right. And keep in mind too that these seraphim have only recently been detained. I mean, the seven crucial years.
Yeah,
are
no,
just
there's
about,
two different things.
Just
though.
About
they're talk,
just about this planet.
They're two different things, Chuck. One is being detained.
Yeah.
The other is being relieved of their responsibilities, which could have happened much earlier.
Right. No, that's what I'm trying to get to. So even though these rebel seraphim were left free on the planet for a long time, relatively, I mean, at least up until Pentecost, it sounds like their responsibilities were taken from them right from the beginning. From
very
the,
early, yeah.
From their decision.
Yeah, that's very interesting.
I don't know
that I can reach that conclusion, but I appreciate that you have, and I see how you could, and I'm open to that. I just don't see that.
Well,
I don't
you
understand
know, if they
why
have
they
changed,
what's left ambiguous.
Ambiguous language.
Yeah.
If they had used the word had instead
becoming.
Of have, it would have made more sense in the past tense. Already had the universal censors arbitrarily taken from these disobedient and unfaithful guardians all aspects of their soul trust. Or at that time they had, it doesn't, it's not clear when this happened, when they were taken.
Right.
Yeah.
Well, the more ambiguous thing is what has become of these Marantia realities after being put in the custody of Volunteer Sakonafim. That's the question. Is that they're still languishing, waiting for some post-adjudication resurrection, or if they've been allowed to just continue on their way in the meantime?
Yeah.
That's
well, they're
ambiguous.
Asleep, if nothing else. I mean, and what do they tell us? Time is of no moment. To sleeping survivors, so, I guess the universe doesn't look at it as a catastrophe if it has to hold you asleep for a few hundred thousand years.
But at least they're safekeeping, I like that.
they're in safekeeping.
There's nothing more precious than our Marantia souls.
You know what occurred to me, though, when you pointed that out, Andre, and even when you read it, was the fact that the rebels in the rebellion in the universe, many have repented, but they are held at that status where they were. This is my understanding of the teachings, that they're held at the status where they were when they rebelled. And that at some point in the future when the rebellion is over, they will return to their former status. They'll be restored to their former status.
Some status.
Is that,
Yeah.
So.
And even the ones who are detained, aren't they like working they have some kind of, they're not like imprisoned, but they're held and they're helping out with other things.
Yeah.
Don't they say
custodial
something about that they're helping with? Right, something like that.
Which we should not
you almost get the sense.
Pushing a broom.
Right.
Sweeping up. Sense they're sort of in a rehabilitative kind of a stage,
Right. But not given a lot of responsibility is what I understand.
Exactly.
You know, they're kind of in limbo themselves.
Mm.
They're in a kind of a limbo.
Yeah, they're not put back in positions of the kind of trust that they had previously. Yeah.
Right.
Right.
That'd be hard to come back from. You know, we talk about Judas a lot. I mean, and that, how hard it would be for Judas to come back from the betrayal of Christ, you know. It would be hard for an angel, a guardian, or any a high order spirit being to come back from rebellion. And they might repent with a full heart, you know, but it would be hard to work their way back to the level of trust needed to be able to, you know.
The irony of that, isn't it, you know, is that, you know, aside from taking Marvin's point into account and that, you know, this could have all been taken care of, you know, with the Adamic dispensation onset, the issue here is interesting that, ironically, Judas might have resurrected, if he survived, okay, into the next life at Michael's resurrection on Easter morning before any of these soul trusts, if they are still in the keeping of the Sekhanafim. You know, and that's just what's ambiguous to me. I'm not saying that
that's
they are necessarily, but
right.
to me, it's not clear that they're not.
Yeah, it is not clear that they're not. I agree. You could interpret it either way, I guess, but it's not clear.
Yeah.
Well, there's the thing about Moses being held. Remember that?
Right.
Up until
the
time
of Pentecost. Resurrection occurred, yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
And
so Caligaster
had
intervened and was not allowing. Yeah.
Yeah. And he still had standing to do that. Because, and that just shows you how seriously they take the assignment of a planetary prince. Remember, after 7 years or so, or however long that was on, or even 2 system years or whatever it was on Gerizim, Lucifer was out. Okay, that was a different deal. That was a different kind of administration. This assignment of planetary prince, responsibility for ascending mortals, is such a sacred trust once assigned, it cannot. There are no takebacks in any easy manner. There is no, I guess we were wrong. That doesn't happen.
Yeah, right.
And he still had standing to make objection and be listened to.
Mm-hmm.
That's pretty remarkable. That's before Michael was invested with being planetary prince at Pentecost, or slightly before, if that was allowed before. You know, when he said, "I saw Satan fall as lightning." It could have been on Mount Hermon that they did that, but officially, for sure, Michael was planetary prince, you know, at Pentecost.
Right.
Yeah.
If not before.
So here are a couple of statements, and I don't know if it extrapolates down to the duties of the angels that we're speaking about. I kind of think it would, but anyways, this is in the history of the rebellion section, paper 53, section 7. It was over 2 years of system time from the beginning of the war in heaven until the installation of Lucifer's successor. But at last, the new sovereign came landing on the Sea of Glass with his staff, and that was Lanaforge. And then the next paragraph, which is paragraph 53, 7, 13. With the arrival of Lanaforge, the arch-rebels were dethroned and shorn of all governing powers, though they were permitted freely to go about Gerizim and launch affairs even to the individual inhabited worlds. They continued their deceptive and seductive efforts to confuse and mislead, but as concerned their work in the administrative mount of Gerizim, their place was found no more. So they were deprived of all their responsibilities. And, you know, it's a live question whether down at the seraphim level, the rebel seraphim were replaced by functional seraphim, guardian seraphim at that time.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, the big turning point was when the arch rebels tried to, you know, persuade Jesus to come over to their side, you know, up on Mount Hermon. And it was after witnessing that the, you know, that all sympathy ended on the, you know, on the mm-hmm. system headquarters world. It mm-hmm. was like, that was just like beyond the pale. But
they,
it was interesting, I think. Yeah. But it's interesting, though, how that kind of upholds the principle, I think, articulated by the Mother Spirit, that unlimited opportunity for sin expression is the quickest way to end rebellion. So the fact mm-hmm. that no objection or hindrance was interjected that would prevent the arch rebels from meeting with Jesus on Mount Hermon, that was like, okay, this is cool, we'll go ahead with this. I mean, there was wisdom in that, in that it ended up bringing the rebellion to an end.
It did.
That giving that kind of opportunity, that kind of unlimited opportunity for sin expression, even to the point of, you know, leaning into a bestowal son to try to, you know, sway him from his determination to do the Father's will, that was so egregious that it changed the hearts, or at least, mm-hmm. you know,
right.
determined the decision of the loyal, all loyal personalities on the system headquarters world. And it was after
yeah.
that the incarceration began.
Yeah.
You know, I was so touched in this section, and it's interesting because, you know, that last paragraph is interesting for sure. But I'm touched by the fact, and when you read it, Andre again brought home that the angels have to go through this process.
Yeah.
If we fail to survive,
yeah,
and they and it's pretty arduous what they have to go through,
yeah,
and
yeah,
they have to be
like
absolved, and it tugs at your heart when you think about, you know, all they get, and especially how difficult it is on this planet to, you know, guide us and lead us through this maze of confusion and, you know, and sorrow and apparent chaos and, you know, rebellion, and then, you know, to have us fail to survive
mm-hmm.
through
mm-hmm.
no fault of their own, but they still have to go through this process where they have to say, well, you know, I tried, you know, this, and I tried that, and I did this other thing, and, you know, everything I could think of, because...
Well, you know, go ahead, Paul, but I want to try and start.
Well, they're
just,
they're all working for our survival. That's paramount. That is paramount.
Yeah, the interesting thing is, I see where you're coming from. You say, well, golly, they tried so hard, they worked so hard, you know, and then they have to go through this grilling. Did you guys screw up in some fashion? But I sort of saw it the other way around, which is the whole purpose of that is, if there's any possibility that this mortal could have received somewhat better ministry in any fashion, then we want to preserve them and give them another chance on the mansion world. So to me, it's an extra step of mercy that they look so carefully at what happened before they allow for the loss of a soul. You know, if there's anything that might have been done by the seraphim or others to that person might have chosen differently, then mercy is extended and they are repersonalized in the mansion worlds and they're not extinguished, is kind of how I was reading it.
Huh. Yeah, I read that as it being too late at that point. That the decision not to survive has already been made.
Except if they do this, they review like this, then there must be, at least theoretically, a situation where the angel is said, well, you could have done this and you could have done that. Their superiors who are much more experienced said, well, there could have been more you might have been able to do right here and here. You could have tried this or that. And then everyone acknowledges, well, maybe we ought to give this being another chance, you know. So somewhere in that, all the way up to the ancients of this, they could reverse it and say, you know, let's extend mercy to this one. We're not quite sure. Maybe they could. There's still a chance. So that's kind of how I see it, is that, you know, no stone is left unturned, kind of.
Right. I mean, they don't actually say that, but could be. It could
be. No.
I mean, that decision to not survive is a will decision of the evolving mortal. like that decision has been made by the mm-hmm. by the ascender. I mean, we choose our
yeah.
own non-survival. I think we're not taken out of existence against our will. If we
no, I agree.
The
question is the maturation of a fully made choice. That's the issue. Were they given that opportunity?
Right.
Is the question? Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, that's going to have to be the stopping point, you guys, and hold that thought, because we'll be back next week with Section 7, which is quite a long section, Seraphim and the Ascendant Career. So what goes on
after this? We should review 6, because there's actually a few more things.
Yeah, we can do that too.
That'd be great, actually.
Yeah, that'd be great,
mm-hmm.
for sure, because I think it's
mm-hmm.
just that
yeah.
last section, so. I think 7 sections
okay.
is the last, isn't it? Or no? Yeah,
mm-hmm.
it's the last
yep.
one in
yep.
this paper, so we can recap. Well, God bless you
great.
Guys. Love you.
Yeah.
Happy Easter.
Yeah. Yep.
Mm-hmm. Good news. He is risen.
That's right. Joyous
yeah.
resurrection.
Joyous resurrection.
See you next week. Post-resurrection.
See you next week. Yeah.
All right.
Yeah. Blazing the trail.
Okay. Bye
God
for now.
Okay.
Bye.
Yeah, have a great week.
You too.
Love you guys.
Love you too.
You've been listening to The Cosmic Citizen, a radio program focused primarily on the study and discussion of the Urantia Book and its teachings. The Urantia Book is a religious text that claims to be written by angels and other superhuman personalities. If you are a Urantia Book reader or a spiritual seeker looking for new truth, we hope and pray you have been nourished and edified by our ministry. Please remember that the views expressed on this program do not reflect the official views and opinions of any Urantia organizations. There is no official interpretation of the Urantia Book. So all opinions expressed on this program exclusively reflect the personal biases of the hosts, guests, and callers who participate in these discussions. And remember, only a brave person is willing honestly to admit and fearlessly to face what a sincere and logical mind discovers.